I'll let you know that I'm Marie-Louise Ayres and I'm Assistant Director General for the Resource Sharing Division. And in welcoming you here today, I'd like to acknowledge the Ngambri and Ngunnawal people who are the traditional custodians of this land and to pay respects to their elders past and present. And I should say that Ed is making a really flying visit here and I've just told him I'm going to make sure his feet get onto real Australian soil on Mount Ainslie later today. So you'll understand the land we're on. I'm really delighted that so many of you have joined us today for our Summer Innovative Ideas Talk. And our guest speaker is Ed, who's currently an Information Technology Specialist at the Library of Congress and also an independent developer who's got a long history of dabbling around the edges of things. I knew that Ed was going to be the right speaker for us when I saw that his original degree was actually in English and American Literature, so that's good. And he then has a Master of Library Studies, both from Rutgers University. But before joining the Library of Congress, Ed worked with a number of different companies and even had a stint as an electronic resources librarian. So for my library colleagues here who are still deep in collection development and how to kind of deal with licences, I think that Ed probably remembers some of that pain. While at the Library of Congress, Ed's worked on numerous projects, including digital preservation, national newspaper digitisation, Twitter archiving, and open data working groups. He's also the creator of Linkipedia, which you should have a look at if you haven't already, a system that's designed to help reveal and foster the connections between digital curation communities and for big institutions like ours to understand where their links are in Wikipedia. So the idea is that if organisations can see how the web content's being used in Wikipedia, they'll be encouraged and emboldened to do some more. So Ed will be discussing today, I guess, the application of information technologies in libraries, how we can make our collections more accessible to all. And we've given him no writing orders, so we're looking forward to quite a free-flowing talk. So please welcome Ed Summers.
Thanks for that lovely introduction. I never really considered that sort of span in my career for quite a bit of time, and it's nice to be reminded of it. The pain of being an electronic resources cataloger, it was actually the pain of being an electronic resources cataloger that kind of got me into doing software development again. So I was kind of a nerdy kid, or is it a geeky kid? 10-year-old, 15-year-old, doing a lot of, just programming at home. And then I kind of forgot that part of my life. And, I did an English degree, and then I did a library degree. And it was in the pain of sort of doing some of the cataloging stuff, sort of, like, repetitive things over and over again, that I sort of was like, oh, yeah, I think maybe I can write a program to do this. And then that's how I sort of found myself doing more programming stuff. So if you do find things that are painful, sometimes they can be kind of a good thing to focus on for a little bit. Thank you for having me here. It's pretty awesome to be invited to come and talk like this, and I'm very grateful. I also am somewhat of a nervous speaker. I'm not like a professional speaker, even though I sort of come from the United States to speak here. This is not something I'm like trained to do. So I have these notes, to basically remind me when I totally go off topic. I thought I'd just tell you a little bit about what I do now. I'm a software developer working at the Library of Congress in the United States, and I imagine you may know what the Library of Congress is already, but we think of it as the de facto National Library of the United States. So it's not actually the National Library of the United States. It's actually a parliamentary library. It's attached to Congress, but we have sort of big goals. We talk about what we do in terms of it being a national library. And a lot of our projects sort of sort of reflect that. You know, they're for the American people. And so we kind of have this weird sort of almost schizophrenic kind of mission. And I work on in a group called the Repository Development Center. It's about 20 people, about half and half staff and contractors. And it's basically a digital preservation group. Digital preservation is kind of a weird, hard word. I think that we don't typically have a really good understanding of what digital preservation means, at least our group. We've had lots of debates about it. About 2 years ago, we didn't even agree what a repository is, right? So what's a repository? And we had arguments about that for too long. But in the end, we kind of came to the understanding that the repository is this building that we're in, right? It's the library is a repository. And when we talk about a digital repository, we're talking about digital stuff that happens to be sort of in the building or we work on, right? And so the digital repository or the Repository Development Center is really just a place where we sort of facilitate the building of digital stuff in the library. And we have different ways of doing that, but that's sort of like the thing that ties us all together. A lot of the requirements around digital preservation are kind of new, and some are high bars to get over, some are low bars. And rather than sort of express like what our group does in terms of those requirements, we've just sort of focused on trying to do useful things for people in the library. My own personal work in the group has focused on the role that access plays in digital preservation, and by access, I mean specifically the web. A few years ago, the RDC, the Repository Development Center, had a retreat. You know, it wasn't really a retreat where we went to some exotic location or anything. It was just like we went to like a room that was there for like a day and a half, 2 days. And we had a big argument about what, we're a digital preservation group, so we shouldn't do access, right? Because access is that other group over there that does the web stuff. But in the process of it, my coworker, David Brunton, he just sort of yelled out, like, you know, digital preservation is just access. It's just in the future. And we were like, And I personally have just been using this as my own like mantra to keep me sane. I really think that he's kind of right. And I was reading an article, Matt Kirschenbaum. I don't know if many of you people know this guy. He's a digital humanities researcher at University of Maryland in the United States. And he has, I was going to read a quote of his. He had a recent article called the Dot Textual Condition. But in it, he says, the preservation of digital objects is logically inseparable from the act of their creation. The lag between creation and preservation collapses completely, since a digital object may only ever be said to be preserved if it's accessible, and each individual access creates the object anew. And this is like David's comment to me, but like in sort of scholarly terms, you know, so I kind of identified with it. So access is really important to me, and I sort of my whole career really has been built around the web. That's been the common theme throughout a lot of it. The web is the web, right? We all kind of know what it is, and we all use it probably every day. And you know, we carry it around in our pockets, you know, on our little phones, and when you're talking about access in the web, it's just kind of a no-brainer. Google estimated that, I read it something from 5 years ago, that Google estimated that they had 1 trillion unique URLs in their index. And it kind of blew my mind a little bit. Like, so 1 trillion URLs is, it's 3 times the number of stars that are in the Milky Way galaxy. It's 9 times the number of people that ever lived. This is all according to Wolfram Alpha, by the way. So maybe it's not right, but I think it might be right, maybe. But interestingly, it's only 5% of the number of red blood cells in a human body, which I found that counterintuitive somehow, like that the number of stars in the galaxy would be smaller than the number of red blood cells in the body. But I guess maybe that's why I'm not an astronomer. One of the things that I... where I was going with that is that it's hard to sort of think about our collections to fit into something like that. Like, how do our collections fit into this larger information space that's the web? And that's kind of what I'm going to try to talk about today. One of the things, so I was just at the National Digital Forum in New Zealand. I don't know, has anybody ever been to that here? Okay, a few people. It's a really good conference. If you get a chance to go to it, I highly recommend it. They're a really enthusiastic, smart group of people. And Wellington is a really cool city. But one of the things that I really appreciated learning about was Simon Tanner was there, and he talked about his balanced value impact model, which sounds kind of like it's going to be dry. And I understand Simon's going to be here tomorrow, so I don't know what his plans are while he's here, but if you get a chance to meet with him or hear him do a workshop or talk, I definitely encourage you to go to it. But his idea is basically, and I'm not doing it justice because I'm just going to mention it very quickly, but the thing that I really heard from it is that we have to think about how what we do has an impact on other people, like changes people's lives, either hopefully for the better, but sometimes for the worse. And we need to sort of measure, like, how we get there. And it's something I'm personally terrible at. Like, I always sort of dabble and experiment and don't really often sort of measure the impact of what I'm doing. So it's something that I hope to do more of. But the thing that I'm going to talk about, I'm really just going to take a tour through some experiments in Access, which I sort of had as my first slide, things that I've sort of dabbled on. So I was really glad to be invited here. Tim Sherritt wrote to me when he saw I was going to be at NDF and was like, is there any chance you could swing back through here? And I was like, yeah, sure. And one thing that I really like that Tim does, he does a lot of experiments around things and sort of has made me sort of think about things in a different way. And I just thought that, well, since I'm coming, you know, here at Tim's, invitation, I was going to just kind of do some of that, basically just show you some experiments. Not all of them are actually mine. Some of them are other people's. And I think what I was hoping to do, so it was really funny seeing Simon talk, because Simon Tanner, about this the impact model, because it made me think that, like, I've actually been trying to sort of characterize the impact that our collections have with these experiments. It's been something that I've sort of unconsciously been trying to do. And so I was really grateful for Simon to sort of make sort of what was unconscious conscious. So when I show you these experiments, maybe think critically about them. Like, does this really, like, show the impact of anything? Or how could it be improved to sort of better show that the impact of our collections? So the last thing I will say before I get into the demos is that I don't know if you're familiar with it, but the writer Paul Ford had a blog post from 2011, which he called "The Web is a Customer Service Medium." Has anybody read this? Anybody? Probably not, because it might be a U.S. thing. Customer service medium definitely sounds like a U.S. thing. But it doesn't sound... The article is a lot more playful than the titles suggest. But his main point is that the web success stories are largely oriented around the principle he calls Why Wasn't I Consulted, which he abbreviates to WWIC. So I'm going to quote him. He says, "Why wasn't I consulted is the fundamental question of the web. It's the rule from which other rules are derived. Humans have a fundamental need to be consulted, engaged, to exercise their knowledge and thus power, and no other medium that came before has been able to tap into that as effectively as the web. So people want to use the web to interact with us. If we fail to give them the ability to interact or don't listen to them, our sites often fail. It's why your newspaper OCR correction service has been so awesome. People want to participate. They want to be part of the work of the NLA. If I squint a bit, the WWIC, or why wasn't I consulted, reminds me a lot of Simon's idea of impact. It's when a web application stops being merely a website and starts to affect people's actual lives that's the impact factor. I'm going to say one more thing before I do the demo too. How much time do I have? I don't want to bore everybody with. Okay, good. So the other thing I wanted to add, which is going to become evident in some of the demos, is that I'm sort of a Wikipedia maniac a little bit. I went to Wikimania in 2012 because it was in D.C. And I had been sort of a dabbler in Wikipedia. I'm not like a maniac in the sense that I sort of spend all my time editing articles. But the thing that really sort of interested me was how our content is used on Wikipedia and sort of the role that cultural heritage organizations have in relation to Wikipedia. I was at the conference, I was just really struck by how passionate everybody was. So there were 1,400 people there, and they were all singing the same tune. And it wasn't like a cult or anything. It was, I mean, I guess there's a cult aspect to it. But the cult was oriented around, I was going to read the mission statement of the Wikimedia Foundation. It's, there's my why wasn't I consulted slide. Their mission statement is to empower and engage people around the world to collect and develop educational content under a free license or in the public domain and to disseminate it effectively and globally. And this was something that everybody just sort of, like, they didn't need to be convinced of it. They were all there because they believed this thing. And I was just really struck by the sort of the educational goal that all these people had in common. They really wanted to spread knowledge around the world. And it made me again think of, well, not at the time, but looking back on it, again, Simon's, impact factor thing just connects. It's like, you know, these are people, their lives were changed enough by this website to travel around the world to talk about it with all these other people. It's really impressive. Within the Wikipedia community, there's this galleries, libraries, archives, and museums effort. That's one of their logos there. And they're really oriented around making Wikipedia a place for us. So libraries, archives, museums, and galleries. Historically, Wikipedia has been sort of sometimes a hard place to get into. It's like, how do I start interacting with people to edit articles or know the right way to do something? And so the GLAM effort was created to sort of help guide people into that space. And Wikipedia really wants to our participation because we have a lot of expertise that they need to make, you know, the resource better. Now, Liam Wyatt, who's sitting here in the front, was, I don't know how many of you know this, but he sort of created this movement, this GLAM movement, and it's sort of spread all around the world. There are Wikipedian in residence, there are residence programs that exist in museums and libraries. There's one at the National Archives in the United States right now, who actually, he just switched to being a staff person. So they liked him so much, they gave him a job. I mention it because, as you're going to see, like these demos that I'm going to do really sort of, some of them just involve Wikipedia, because I really think that it's an extension of what we do, right? So I'm saying lots of ums and ahs because I'm not reading from my paper. So let me just dive into some of these demos. If you have a question and feel comfortable asking it, feel free to do that. It's entirely up to you. I don't mind stopping and actually would help probably. So I thought I would just start by telling you about a project at the Library of Congress. American Memory, has anybody heard of American Memory before? Okay. It's basically, it started in 1990 as an effort to digitize, you know, unique items at the Library of Congress and put them on laser discs and then, like, ship them out to schools and universities around the country so that they could have remote access to things that are unique at the library. And then in 1993, the web started to take off, and there were some developers at the library. So 93 was still pretty early in the days of the web, but they were like, there were some, like, a pocket of, like, really sort of cutting-edge people at the library, I guess, that were like, yeah, this web thing is starting to, like, self-organize. Like, we should try to get the stuff off the DVDs and onto the web. And so they kind of did that, and then in 1995 it was released. I was just going to show you. So American Memory is looking quite dated now because it's been around so long. It's really quite, I'm just going to click through. I mean, there are lots of different ways. It's almost like Yahoo, you know, like sort of like a very hierarchical kind of feel to it, or at least what Yahoo used to be. And it's very much oriented around collections. So it's kind of like this umbrella thing for, like, all these other little collections. Library of Congress is very much that way. Like, everybody sort of has their bits of content that they sort of understand. And sometimes it's hard to get people to think sort of a little bit more broadly. So American Memory was trying to sort of break down the barriers between those little collections. Eventually, if you you keep clicking, let's see. Eventually, you get to an item, right? And it's you know, this is it's a nice photograph, right? And I did, this is one random. I didn't select this beforehand, but I guess where I'm going with this is that you know, people at the Library of Congress, after so much time had passed, they sort of thought of the site as sort of not dead, but just sort of like it's not being used anymore. It's kind of like this boring thing that they should make it look better and more modern. But I wondered, like, how much is this content actually used? Before I go there, though, I'm going to take a brief segue. So as part of the thinking about how to imagine the content, like, in a newer way, they decided to pull some of the content out and put it into Flickr. And they've actually wrote a pretty good report about this, which I've sort of got there down along the bottom, that for the common good. Has anybody seen this before? I mean, this is something you guys do too, right? Yeah. So it's not unique to the Library of Congress. Yeah, basically, so this presentation is quite a bit nicer, right? Like, people see the content up front. They don't have to dig, like, six levels deep and then finally see a photograph. This is sort of putting the content first. The thing that the report kind of goes into is sort of documenting the effects that this had on the content. So I think it was a 200% increase in traffic to the original website. So, because you can follow links from this content into the Library of Congress website. So they saw a lot of referral traffic from Flickr. They also saw, it also enabled people to tag things and describe things in a way that they couldn't on the old site because there was no user interaction at all. So it really kind of fed into the the why wasn't I consulted kind of thing. Like, it gave people a voice to say things. And the report goes into a study of, like, sort of how what kind of tags people used. But it's very much sort of, you know, Simon Tanner, he kind of he pointed out that just because if you just talk about increased traffic to your website, or, you know, let's say our newspaper site gets 5 million hits a day on the web server, which is true, it gets 5 million requests. But what does that actually say about the impact that site is having? All it is a measure of is the scale. it's not really a measure of the impact that it's having on people's lives. So that's my one criticism of the of that Flickr report there. Linkipedia was mentioned in my intro, and I thought I would just give you a quick look at it. This was an experiment that I just did sort of on my own time. And I meant to take a walk through it before I got up here, just in case it wasn't running. Okay. So the idea of Linkipedia is Wikipedians all the time, when they're editing articles, they have to, you know, they make claims, right? They say things about a topic. And unless they back up their claim with a citation to somewhere, then, you know, sometimes articles can get deleted, right, because they're not cited enough. Sometimes what you say can be deleted because you haven't cited it. And so what I thought would be interesting would be to sort of invert the citations. So to look at, let's say, Trove and say, well, how many articles on Wikipedia are using Trove as a source for citation? This might take a little bit of time for it to do its thing. So like I said, I did this on my own time, and so it's running on this little teensy server that I have. And it's actually, I'm thinking of redoing it, because now Wikipedia has a labs environment where you can run things, and so it would run quite a bit faster there. So, you know, at first you just see summary information, which is like Simon's point, right? It doesn't really tell you a whole lot. It's just a number. But the thing that's fun is seeing the pages. So these are actually the articles that Wikipedia is pointing from to Trove. And the number you see on the second column is how many links there are on that article. So it's actually, so there's some articles, like, so this one here has 54. Well, that's not, so you see the ones that start with user colon. These are actually not so much articles as they are sort of user pages. So you see this quite often because Wikipedia users, as they're preparing to do work on an article, they'll often have it like a scratch space where they'll do stuff. So you see those pop up, but there are lots of articles in here. So here's Fred Dyer, and it has 55. Let's just click on it. It has 55 links apparently to Trove. So he was a boxer, I guess. So if we go down here, I mean, look at all this content about this boxer. It's just, I don't know. Still blows my mind. But look at all these citations. All these are references, and a bunch of them are to Trove, right? One thing I was going to show you is the reason why I created Linkipedia also was that. So helped create the National Digital Newspaper Project, which is similar to Trove in that it provides access to newspaper content, but in the United States. And we were curious about how content was being used on Wikipedia. And I thought it would be neat to have a feed, basically, that I could, does anybody still use feed readers here? Like for blogs and a handful? Yeah. Well, maybe I won't talk about this then, because it might be kind of boring. But I'll just mention it really quickly for those of you that do. For Trove, there's a little link here for, it's a syndicated feed link, but basically if you use a feed reader, you can add that URL to your feed reader and then you get updates. So it's basically the same effect as, so rather than reading a whole bunch of websites, a feed reader is one place where you read things that have been added to a bunch of websites. And I thought it'd be interesting to be able to just track who's using or how content is being referenced in my feed reader. So here you can see it runs every 5 days, kind of, to look for updates. So it's not like real time or anything. But you know, these are the articles that they're sorted by time now, basically. The other interesting thing is, and this was another reason why I created it too, was to give you potentially, it's something that you have with your newspaper site that's really nice, is that you sort of can have a relationship with your users. So you have these users that are like super OCR correctors, and you kind of know who they are. And apparently I just learned this morning that you have had meetings where you've invited them in and talked about how to improve the site, which is just awesome. Like I wish I could say that we were doing similar things at the Library of Congress as that, because it's in those conversations that you really learn a whole lot about what a website can do, what it should do, what it shouldn't do, and just, you know, make it much more usable. So this page here in Linkipedia was just showing you some of the users. So users have their own profile pages on Wikipedia. I just thought it'd be interesting to see which ones actually talk about. So in this case, it's ones that talk about Trove. So these are users that have profile pages that talk about Trove. The idea being that maybe, you know, they'd be good to talk to about, like, your website and, you know, how to improve things, or just to have a chat, you know. Some people might find that scary, too, I think. I don't know. Is anybody scared by that? Okay. Nobody, I guess. That's good. So I did not create Pinterest, but I have it up here. Because I just, as a follow-on to the Linkipedia discussion, I thought I would just show that you can go to a particular URL on Pinterest and you can see all the content that was added from a particular domain. So this is Trove's page on Pinterest. So you can see these are all images that people added from Trove. Has anybody seen this before? Okay. So I'm not telling you anything new. But then you can... You can click through and eventually end up on Trove. I thought, well, again, this is another opportunity, right? So these are people that really sort of like your content. And it's an opportunity to sort of to potentially to communicate with them. And this was something I wanted to build into Linkipedia, but I never did. But maybe I still will. But it's a communication channel that you potentially have with your users and users that sort of like what you do. So I'm going to take. So this is another example from Wikipedia. When I first started getting into Wikipedia, it was because I went to a presentation that somebody that BBC gave about their BBC music site. So they have a music website where every artist has a page. And they demoed this thing where they wanted to change, so it was a Bob Dylan page, I think, and they wanted to change some of the text on it. And to change it, they went to Wikipedia and changed the content, and then it was changed on the BBC page. And I was like, what? What just happened? and I got talking with them afterwards, and, you know, they had... So every change that happens on Wikipedia... There's this thing called IRC, Internet Relay Chat, but it's like this old kind of, almost like chat, like what you have with Instant Messenger, but it's like these channels, basically. And so every Wikipedia channel has its own, every Wikipedia language has its own channel. And if you go to the channel, you basically just see all the edits flying by. And so I went into it for the first time and looked at it, and I was just blown away by how quickly all these edits went by. And I was like, I had no idea that... Wikipedia changed so much. So I really wanted to build an application that sort of showed that to other people that didn't want to get an IRC client and log into this weird IRC server. And if it works, maybe. Sometimes there's a little lag. And you probably will not be able to see this in the back. I apologize. Or maybe you won't be able to see it at all. Oh, okay, here it goes. So this is, it's a view of edits as they're happening. So each line that is going down is a Wikipedia article. And then the images, I'm sort of rolling the dice with the images. So the images are ones uploaded to the commons. So Wikipedia has a commons for image content, I think video content too. So the image will change depending on, it doesn't show all the images because it would just, the background would just be changing all the time. So periodically it looks for the right size of an image to display, which has bitten me a couple times because not, you know, sometimes not all the images that are uploaded are suitable for showing to them. So one of the things you can do is you can limit to, let's say we just want English Wikipedia. We don't want, see, these are all the Wikipedias. Actually, it's not even all of them. It's just the top ones. So we can limit to just English. I don't know if you can see back there, but the icons there, so you'll see some of them are blue heads, and then some of them are a little gray, like robot heads. And then some are red sort of faces with a question mark in them. And so the blue ones are actually people with accounts. So a registered Wikipedia user, anybody can register, but it's people that go through the effort of logging in. The red ones with question marks are just anonymous users. So you know, in Wikipedia, anybody can edit, and you don't even have to log in. So the red ones are those people. And then the gray robot-looking things are software. So there's a lot of software is updating Wikipedia, looking for vandalism, all this kind of stuff all the time. So, yeah, that's that. This was a lot of fun to do because one of my heroes as a software developer, Ward Cunningham, he created the wiki, he wrote to me and said that he had tried to do this before and just the tools weren't there. I mean, it took me probably a day and a half to do it. Just because the tools were there, I just sort of stuck them together like Lego and it worked. But it was just so nice to get an email from somebody like one of your like heroes that was just saying, I tried to do this thing too and you did a nice job, thank you. It meant a lot to me. Oh, and you can click on these and go see the edit if you want. I'm not going to do that right now, but basically, it'll take you to the change. And you can pause it too if you want. If you press P, it sort of pauses it. And then. So this, of course, led to another thing. I was like, oh, that was too easy. I have to do something else. So I created this very simplistic thing that sort of shows, some of them are sort of half on the screen, but basically this just shows the edits per minute in Wikipedia. So the big dial is all of Wikipedia combined, but then the smaller ones are all the specific language Wikipedias, including the commons and this project called Wikidata, which is down at the bottom. And I just thought it was, it is what it is. It's not really having much impact, right? But it's sort of I liked it because it kind of gave sort of a feel for the way that Wikipedia is being used. In particular, I was surprised at Wikidata, which is a fairly new project. But yeah, a lot of it, I mean, so they're doing 143 edits per minute right now, which is a good chunk of the overall editing. And also sometimes you'll see spikes, you know, where some of the languages will just go, you know, like, you know, they're stepping on it or something, you know. So this is not something that I did, but I wish that I did. And it kind of grew out of the wiki stream thing that I did. So I actually didn't have any conversations with them, but they ended up using the same similar technique to getting the changes out of Wikipedia. But the cool thing that they did was they sort of, well, I'll show it to you. So what these are, they're all, you know, the edits being in real time. That bar that came across the top was because a new user had signed up to Wikipedia. The size of the circle is the size of the edit. Oh, it doesn't look nearly as good up there as it does on my laptop. Sorry about that. And then the colors, if you go to your workstation and look at it, it's much better. But the color of the edit too is like whether it's an anonymous user or a registered user. And the there's two sounds, like there's a bell, which is an addition to Wikipedia, and the little pluck is a subtraction from Wikipedia. So I was surprised that I kind of listened to this for way too long one time. this is another experiment toy thing. So I mentioned I work on this newspaper site, and it's very similar to what Trove does. It's not as big as Trove, but it provides access to 6 million newspaper pages. And one of our management folks were doing a demo. There was a conference going on for the National Digital Newspaper Program, which this website is sort of the flagship thing for. And he really wanted to sort of show how active the site was. So we created this little app called Chroma, which is not available right now. So Chroma, basically what it showed was as people were coming to the website, you just basically see a line, kind of like with Wikistream. And you'd see sort of the state and the name of the newspaper and the page that they were landed on. You just sort of saw them go down. And you also saw, like, when people were searching, so like a person's name or a name in a state or a name in a time period or just a time period. So you saw all this variability in, like, how they were searching. We have, reports that sort of summarize the statistics. But sometimes it's hard to kind of get a feel for it because you see them sort of at the aggregate level. Like, they've already been aggregated. You only see the things that are at the top. And seeing them sort of scroll by, you can kind of get more of a sense of how people are searching. We noticed some ways that the search form was being used incorrectly because of this. I'm sorry I can't show it to you. This is another little experiment with a newspaper site where we used Twitter to basically, to every day it will look at 100 years ago today, and I should have looked to see what it tweeted. So 15 hours ago, it tweeted third warrant issued for specialist. Hopefully that's not me. I'm a specialist, but yeah, it just basically uses our API to search for. It does a little bit of work to try to find the best. Because OCR can be kind of noisy, so it tries to find the best chunk of text that it can based on an English dictionary. And interestingly, over time, we've been running it for like a year and a half, and we've noticed that the text has gotten better, and I think that that's largely the result of our OCR getting better over time. And also the quality of the newspapers, I think, has gotten better too, at least the legibility of it. So it's been kind of weird to see the Twitter streams sort of reflect that. And you guys have a similar one. It's a Trove News bot, right, which does the same thing, but it does it more often. So I think it goes every hour or something, or every few hours maybe, a few hours. But, yeah, it's kind of interesting to just see it pop up in your Twitter stream. The British Library have a somewhat similar project that they came up with recently called the Mechanical Curator. And it's on Tumblr, which is similar to Twitter, but you're sort of less constrained what you can put up there. And they basically wrote some software that periodically, randomly, tries to find an image, and not like a complete image, but like a detail of an image, and then just puts it up onto Tumblr. And it's really quite, and then it has a nice little description of the content that's putting up there too. But it's all, so this was selected just by a computer, right? It's no, there wasn't anybody else involved in it. So it's totally random, right? Do you have that expression here, random? Like if something's random? Yeah, okay. And this is probably going to be the last one I show you. This is another Wikipedia experiment, but about earlier this year, they came up with a way to, so you know, we looked at that Wikipedia article on that boxer, and there was a nice image of him on the upper right. And not all articles have images in them. And so what the Wikipedia decided to do, or the Wikimedia Foundation, was to make a button so that if an article doesn't have an image, it's really easy to upload one. And so I was thinking about that, and I was like, yeah, that's pretty cool, because if I'm, you know, if I happen to be somewhere and I notice that there is not an image, I could take a picture of it and upload it. So that's how this project was born. EC for the French, you know, for here, but it also kind of sounded like wiki to me, so that was my little play on words. So what it should do if it's working is, so it uses the geo features in HTML5 so that the browser based, it's all running in the browser. There's really no server side to this other than just serving up the HTML and JavaScript. What it does is it asks the browser, where am I right now? And the browser will, give you the lat lon. I think it uses Wi-Fi and different things to figure it out. And then Wikipedia has a nice geo API, so you can give it lat lon coordinates, and you can get back Wikipedia articles that that are for that location. So I just put them on a map, and I think so. Is the library here? Is that yeah? And so these little red, see the red ones here. These are all ones articles that don't have an image. The blue ones are just articles that are, you know, that you can look at if you want. You just click on it, and it'll give you the little summary of it. But then you can go, if you really want, you can click on that to go to the article. And then the orange ones are ones where somebody's flagged it as needing a citation. So there's something that's been said that, Liam can probably explain better what that means. The citation needed is when either the editor or somebody else decides that something needs a citation, right? Prove it, yeah. So those are things that kind of need to have proof. The reason why I created it was for things like this. So what is that? That's the Pandora archive. Oh, I was meaning to do this while I was here, was to go and just like, I don't know if there is a physical place that the Pandora archive is, but I could just go take a picture of it. Okay. and so on your mobile device, which I don't have here, but I did take a screenshot of it. So if you follow that link to Pandora Archive on your phone, you'll get that's what it looks like when you bring up the text for it. But if you click on the link, you'll go to Wikipedia, and it looks like that on your phone. And you see the little like image with a plus sign on the right upper right portion of it right here. If you click on that, then it basically, at least on the iPhone, I don't know what it does on Android, but I think it does a similar thing. Basically just says, do you want to choose an existing photo or take a photo? And you choose, and it steps you through, I think, just two pages, maybe, to upload the photo from your phone to Wikipedia. You assert, like, the license associated with it, and that's it. And then it's on Wikipedia in the article. Like, so it was pretty cool. Yeah, that was actually the end of my presentation. I feel like I should sum up somehow, but I really, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have about any of the specifics. either later or now. I basically just wanted to sort of encourage you to take advantage of playing a lot with your collection. So you have Tim here, and I think he's a really good example of the kind of work that you can do sort of around your collections to inform what you're supposed to be doing. You're lucky to have him. And also, I wanted to encourage you to look at Wikipedia, too, and to take advantage of Liam here, because he's a big shot in the Wikipedia world. I don't know how much that spreads out into the rest of the organization, but, yeah, he's a real asset, and we've learned a lot from him in the States, so I encourage you to do so. That's all I have for you. Thanks for inviting me.
I think we actually might leave questions just for individually, because I know lots of people have to rush back to work at 1:30. But, Ed, I just wanted to say that when in doubt, I fall back on poetry. And I'm going to share a poem with you called Country Press, which is actually about the way that the text in a newspaper becomes the physical space, becomes the lives of the people around it. And I actually think that that's what Ed has been talking to us about today, about getting our content out there, connecting both with spaces and with lives. And to move on to Simon's talk tomorrow, to think about really what the impact of that is. But I hope that when we're thinking about play, we can't always be thinking, I'll play here and have an impact there. That's the opposite of what we need. So I think you might need people like me to think about impact and people like you to play. So thanks very much then, Ed. So, okay, thank you.